Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on? That regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass whatever legislation they like. They find themselves bound by what is popular, or at least their sense of it. They can only act within a narrow set of ideas, and that range is called the Overton Window. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look at issues around the country and talk to the people who change what is politically possible. Now, if you've ever listened to a speech that hit you like a ton of bricks, you probably heard it in person. There is something special about live speakers, and I say that as the host of a podcast. So today we are joined with someone who is an expert at making sure that your remarks hit their mark. Bob Ewing is the founder and president of the Ewing School, a speaking, listening, and leading consultancy. Bob, welcome.
Thanks, James. I appreciate you having me on.
What makes a good speech?
What makes a good speech? A good speech is a speech that connects and resonates with the audience.
Is that it? That sounds so easy.
We could spend a lifetime digging through all the different components. We like to talk about three core components that make an effective speech, and we call them messaging, delivery, and audience. And if we were going to expand on that a little bit, when we work with our clients, I like to think of five core areas if we break out messaging a bit, right? And so I like to use the acronym BASIS, like what's the basis for effective public speaking, where B stands for big idea. What's the one core insight that you want to drive home to your audience? So when they walk away, that's what we were talking about, right? And then, so you have big idea, and then A stands for audience focused. A good presentation isn't one that you can just take and redo the exact same thing the next time. It's tailored to a specific audience, focused on them rather than yourself, saying, who's my audience? What are they interested in? And how can I create value for them? And then the S stands for structure, is thinking through some sort of structure. We don't like folks to try to write everything out verbatim, but having some sort of clarity on not only the big idea, but how am I pulling it together in a coherent way so it will really resonate with the audience, really knowing my beginning, my end, knowing the key things that I'm putting in there. And then S, structure, and then I, illustrations. What are the vivid concrete details, the stories, the analogies? If the structure is the skeleton, then the illustrations would be all that meat and the good stuff that really brings it to life. And then finally, delivery or stage presence is thinking through, if messaging is what we say, delivery is how we say it. When we get up on stage, or when we're talking to someone face to face, we're meeting with a big donor or an important client or a conversation with a loved one, how are we actually communicating, right? Not what are we saying, but how are we saying it?
So this is a really subtle art. For one, of just like having a message that resonates with your audience, that requires you to know who's sitting, who your audience really is, and what they could possibly hear, and what's something that's actually going to appeal to them. I mean, that's some complicated stuff.
It is, right? And so here's the thing is, like, we've been talking our entire lives. Talking is natural. Mm-hmm. What's unnatural is writing out scripts. Like, that's actually hard. Writing is hard. Writing is not natural. Speaking is natural. So speaking is not actually hard. What's hard to do is to speak well. That takes effort, right? You can think about authenticity and eloquence that are often out of sync with each other. And when we're talking conversationally, we tend to be high on authenticity, but we're often low on eloquence. We ramble. We focus too much on ourselves rather than our audience. We don't hit the key ideas we want. And so
we are a podcast host who talks too much and doesn't let the guest speak. Yes, I'm familiar with this.
The key, and I love to talk, so I'll do my best to not ramble too much here, right? But the key is to say, I want to get my eloquence up and then restore my authenticity. The problem that most people have is once they start to prepare for important public speaking opportunities is they start to increase their eloquence and they lose their authenticity and they enter what Chris Anderson, a popular speaking coach, calls the uncanny valley. And you feel awkward and uncomfortable and most people retreat. What really effective spokespeople do. I'm meeting with Greg Lukianoff in a little bit today, the president of FIRE, right? Something that Greg does, he doesn't naturally like to speak, but he puts a lot of effort in. And then he ends up doing a really good job and you push through the uncanny valley. So you have all of the eloquence from all of that preparation and then you restore your authenticity. And that's where the magic comes in.
What are some examples of simple, big ideas that your clients have delivered?
Okay, well, let's go back to Greg. Greg got to deliver a commencement address recently, and his commencement address was just, the big idea was five words. Right now, Greg runs FIRE, which is the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, and they focus on free expression and free speech. And so Greg's commencement address to graduating doctors was, certainty is the mind killer. Mm. And he said it over and over and over. Certainty is the mind killer. We need to be open-minded. We need to listen. We need to consider new ideas. Certainty is the mind killer. I also worked with Christina Martin from Pacific Legal Foundation, and they are an absolutely world-class team of incredible lawyers that are going into battle to actually make progress in the world in terms of moving the ball forward. I got to work with her on a Supreme Court argument for a landmark property rights case called Tyler v. Hennepin County. The law is super complicated, and yet she was able to get that big idea down to just a handful of simple words. And it was, the government cannot take more than it's owed. And that's it, right? And we hear about how divided the Supreme Court is. Christina was so effective in her legal briefs, so effective in her argument, that when the court issued its ruling, it was 9-0. Unanimous ruling in favor of Christina Martin, saying that when their legal ruling came out, the Supreme Court basically said, the government cannot take more than its own, right? Exactly what she was saying in oral argument and in her legal brief. So that big idea, even at the most complex environments, in the most complex settings, we can still take it and boil it down to its essence. And effectively communicated.
I love that example because I've looked at this issue before. They had some cases involving the state of Michigan. And I think I heard that formulation, the government cannot take more than is owed, before I even knew who was presenting or what exactly they were doing. It's like, this is a message that's like, oh yeah, that strikes to my sense of fairness. I don't know an awful lot about government foreclosure rules, but that seemed like a good principle that's instantly recognizable as a standard of fairness involved in this issue. How long did that take to figure out?
Pacific Legal Foundation does particularly well with their communications. Mm-hmm. They have a whole team of exceptional communicators and the legal scholars themselves at the highest level. Steven Anderson's the president. Larry Salzman is the head of litigation. They put a lot of work. They're exceptional communicators, and they put a lot of work into saying, we're fighting every case in two courts, court of law, court of public opinion. So that's not the kind of thing where it's at the very last minute right before they're going out into court, they work with a contractor who figures everything out. This is built into the DNA of every case that they take. And we work together. And on the cases I get to work with them on, I'm part of a team of really highly mm-hmm. skilled people that's helping to think through, okay, let's take all of this complexity and let's figure out a way to clarify the big idea, to bring to life the stories and analogies and vivid concrete details and the structure that we need to really resonate with this specific audience in this specific way.
Brings up one of the things that I know I struggle with. Why is it that we policy wonks struggle to try to deliver the big idea? Like we thrive on the complexity. This is difficult and sometimes non-standard for us.
So I have to tell you,
I can give you 600 words all day. Five is tough.
There's a fantastic quote from Mark Twain said, I wrote you a long letter. I didn't have the time to write you a short one.
Sure.
And, Woodrow Wilson has a quote where FIRE actually just did a podcast on how bad Woodrow Wilson is, and there's a whole bunch of things he's bad at. But one thing he was good at was speaking. And he had a great line where he said something to the effect of, the spirit of his quote was something to the effect of, if I have 3 hours to talk, I'm ready to go. If I have 3 minutes to talk, I need 3 weeks to prepare. Right?
And so I this can is see the that. Thing.
Yeah. It is that. When you achieve excellence in something, you have so much knowledge and excitement and enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. And so it's really easy to get into the weeds, and it's really hard to avoid the curse of knowledge. The best book ever written on messaging in for all communication, not just for speaking, is called Made to Stick by the Heath Brothers. And at the end of that book, and they hammer you on curse of knowledge throughout the book. And at the end of the book, when they updated it, they said, if we could have rewritten this book, the one thing we would do different is we would hammer even more the fact that curse of knowledge afflicts us all. And so our default is to communicate in a way that our audience is going to struggle to understand us. And that's part of eloquence, is saying, I'm going to put in the work and run the reps and get feedback from other people so I can be sure by the time I go on stage for important speaking events and opportunities and conversations, I'm effectively connecting with my audience.
When you say run the reps, how do you run the reps on condensing your ideas?
Well, I like to think about it as dividing it again in different ways. When we're trying to come up with messaging and clarify who our audience is and how we can best create value for them and how do we structure all of this stuff, that requires what Cal Newport calls deep work. And it's best to block off fairly large chunks of time to really dive into yourself to figure that stuff out, to dive into research, to dive into yourself, to go for a long walk or a bike ride or a hike or a run, and really make the time to think through this stuff. It also pops up in little bits and bobs. And so I always encourage clients to bring with them, have a tool like Otter that they bring with them, which is an app that allows you to record what you're saying. And then it transcribes it. So then you could just get a transcription of random thoughts. Like when you're out running, an idea comes up, like capture it then. Or when you're in the shower. The reason shower thoughts are a thing is they're the last refuge of solitude. There's no glowing rectangles distracting us, right? So for creative work requires space, which is different from skill development. Skill development requires iteration. Right. And so if you're trying to think through what am I going to say about this talk or how am I going to really connect with this specific audience, give yourself space for the ideas to emerge and to get polished. And that requires space and creativity and effort. For skill development, you could do that in super short 30-second reps. Right. And so you saw this when we were together at Mackinac last month, right? Is let's iterate. And I like to quote the philosopher Naval Ravikant when he says, it's not 10,000 hours that leads to excellence, it's 10,000 iterations. And that's how progress happens in our universe. That's how natural selection creates wealth. That's how markets create prosperity. That's how skill development happens, how engineers build bridges that function, is we iterate based on feedback. And so if you say, okay, I'm focusing on developing my skill of eye contact, run 3 30-second reps on anything and then get feedback each time, record it and watch it, or have people in the room that you're talking to, right? And so quick iterations for skill development and long periods for creativity.
I like that point a lot because it reminds me of what an old choir director of mine said, practice doesn't make perfect. Perfect practice makes perfect. We got to keep practicing then things until they get better. Eloquence and authenticity, those are two things that you can work on, that you can practice. Tell me why what goes into the practice to work on those? Because obviously you can work on, if you're not a great public speaker, you're not making one mistake, you're making 1,000 mistakes. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can work on 1,000 mistakes at once.
There is one of the great business books of the last decade or two is a book called The One Thing. And you don't have to read the book, but the spirit of the book, it starts with a Russian proverb, which is he that chases two rabbits catches neither. And that's 1,000% true, is we cannot multitask our attention. And so when we're talking about skill development, we have to give our full attention to whatever it is that we're working on. And so you'll often see people say, okay, for round two, I'm going to fix this and this and this and this and this. And I'll say, okay, pick one of those. Which one's the most important right now? And let's work on just that one. And everything else can fall apart. If you throw one ball up in the air, you're probably going to catch it if you don't throw it too far, right? If you throw 1,000 balls up in the air, it's a mess. And so you throw one ball up in the air, not too far, just a little bit of progress, a little bit of progress, a little bit of progress. And every time you might go up, you might go down, you might make progress, you might not. But with enough iterations, we're going to make transformational growth, right? And so that's it. It's that compounding interest on small iterations that create all of the magic. And it's one at a time, one at a time, one at a time. I'm just going to focus on eye contact. Then I'm just going to focus on my posture. Then I'm just going to focus on my hands. Then I'm just going to focus on whatever it may be. One thing at a time.
How long have you been doing this?
I started my company 6 years ago. And before that, I was the director of training at the Mercatus Center, a at George Mason University, which is an economic research center. Before that, I was the director of communications for a public interest law firm called the Institute for Justice. Mm-hmm. And I started at IJ about 20 years ago. And before that, I worked in sales and always had an interest in interacting with people and would read books for fun on communications and sales and connection and philosophy. And so I think all of that got integrated. It's hard to say when it actually officially started, but by 2005, about 20 years ago, I was working at the Institute for Justice on their communications team, helping attorneys to explain complex legal ideas in clear and compelling terms.
You reiterate, or you're bringing up a point that I think is a recurring theme of this podcast, which is sales skills are ridiculously underappreciated. They're underappreciated in policy wonkery. They're underappreciated. I mean, I think fundraising people know that they're important, but I think communications people, all across the policy landscape, everyone could stand to use a little bit more sales. So in your experience with this, and you've probably worked on a lot of people's presentations. Can you give me an example of a speech that helped shift the Overton window?
Yes, absolutely. Can you hear me? It just said I was muted.
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Okay. Yeah, I can give you a whole bunch. I'll start by giving you a couple of historical examples, and then maybe we could talk about a couple of more recent examples.
Mm-hmm.
I think that when you think about huge policy victories, right, what causes those policy victories to happen? And the biggest, most important policy victory in history was, I think, abolishing slavery. It's like, how did that happen? Right. And there's a whole structure to social change. And as you know, the Overton window is downstream from other things. Right. The politicians, the whole point of like Overton's thesis here is that politicians are responding to things that are happening around them. They're not shifting that Overton window so much as they're finally attuned to it to know what they can talk about and what they can advance. And so it's like, what's upstream from what's inside the Overton window? And I would argue that you start with ideas, right? They're the fountainhead of social change. And then from ideas, people often think, well, once I have this idea in place, then all I need to do is create the policy. I'm going to write the white paper and then it's going to happen, right? And it never does, right? Very rarely, because policy is downstream from politics. And if you've got bad politics, you're going to have bad policy. But the politicians, as Joe Overton made clear, is downstream from culture. In culture, I think, is downstream from stories. And stories are downstream from ideas. And so I think that the most important thing for us to think about is to say, if I want to enact better ideas, I need to figure out what's the framework through which people are going to view those ideas. What are the stories people are going to carry? Because the stories that we carry determine the lives that we live, the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves and the stories that we tell others. Right. And then those stories change the culture, and then the culture changes the politicians, and the politicians change the policies. Right. And so the two examples that I use for this, just broadly speaking about storytelling, are marriage equality and nuclear power. Mm-hmm. Right. Marriage equality in the United States, the Overton window shifted dramatically from one TV show, Will and Grace. Every Democratic politician just a dozen years ago is opposed to marriage equality. Every major one, right? Hillary Clinton, yeah. Obama, Biden, all of them, right? And then the Overton window shifted.
Oh, and that, and then that was an evidence of like where people were at kind of at the time, which was
they
were probably fundamentally sympathetic to marriage equality, but they didn't feel like advancing it would benefit their political careers. And so they didn't. And that changed.
Totally. Totally. My personal opinion is that Obama was totally in favor of marriage equality, and maybe Hillary Clinton wasn't. She's actually quite religious, and she may have thought that I think maybe she may not have been until the cultural pressure was so much that she had to be in order to win votes. Nuclear power on the other end, clean, safe, green, incredible energy, but the story around it ended up conflating it with nuclear bombs, which of course are horrible, right? And so we ended up losing out on this amazing technology that as a result, we've had over 100, 200 million people die of air pollution. We've exacerbated climate change and all this other stuff that if we got the stories better on nuclear power early on, we could have had we could have had the Overton window shifted in our favor rather than against it. Now, in terms of specific speeches, I would say abolition of slavery, Frederick Douglass. Mm. In Britain, there were the Quakers and there was Wilberforce and all this amazing stuff. But in our country, Frederick Douglass, the greatest public speaker, storyteller in American history, was relentless in talking about and advocating for the abolition of slavery. Just look at his 1852 talk, What to the Slave is the 4th of July. 8 years before secession. It was an absolute rhetorical masterpiece. And everyone who, it became so popular, people would read it every 4th of July out loud. They still do today. It shifted. It fundamentally changed the culture of the United States, right? Frederick Douglass single-handedly changed the way Americans saw abolition, and it allowed for the Overton window to be shifted.
Yeah. So to kind of go back to your thing about like how the process works, and this is just a theory. There are people who have studied this and know a little bit more about the culture change than I do on this. But one of the things I think was an idea that it changed the world was moving from an honor-based society to a dignity-based society. And people already kind of knew what that meant in that era of America. But when you start taking dignity seriously, you recognize that slaves are people too and are endowed with rights and are not being treated well. And Frederick Douglass had an amazing story to tell about mm-hmm. the dignity of man and the indignities of slavery. So great example. I love that.
Yeah, right. And another one is Winston Churchill, mm-hmm. right? He's also an excellent example of big idea. Never give in. Never give in. Never, never, never. Okay, I get it, right? Right, never give in, right? And so without Churchill, there's a very plausible argument to be made that the Japanese and the Germans win World War II. Mm-hmm. And you fundamentally shift human civilization. I would say that Frederick Douglass and Winston Churchill, their speaking skills, their storytelling skills, fundamentally altered human civilization in a transformationally positive way and allowed the Overton window to be shifted in a dramatic way.
Let me chew on that for a second. So Frederick Douglass already kind of covered that. Winston Churchill was also a massive policy nerd. He was an aristocrat. He made a bunch of mistakes over his life. And he was kind of known, had like a reputation, especially going into World War II, as a war hawk. But he also had something else. And that was that rhetorical fire that you mentioned. And theoretically, helping fortify the British at a low point. I can see that.
Yeah, and normally we don't think of we think of politicians as being downstream from cultural change. Mm-hmm. I would say, in Churchill's case, I would argue that Neville Chamberlain was saying like, "We're not going back to war. We were devastated in World War One. Mm-hmm. We're not doing it." And there was just this appeal. Everyone was folding. All the countries were folding to Hitler, and Churchill stood up and said, "Never give in," mm-hmm. and he rallied the country and the world.
Yeah,
to stand up and fight.
Well, that's a dueling sentiment issue too, because you had one thing for like we've seen this before. It was a tragedy. It was a mess. We're learning from the past. We're not doing it. Versus no, this time we got to do something because it's really important. Mm-hmm. And at that point it winds up being. I mean, British politics is weird, but I do think if no one had shared Churchill's sentiment, if Churchill was not able to expand his sentiments to the broader public to support them, he would never have wound up in the role that he did and serving the role he did in history.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So let's talk about something that some of the work that your clients have done to try and shift the Overton window.
Sure. Like I was just mentioning with Christina Martin, mm-hmm. that was a landmark property rights case that shifted the Overton window in terms of talking about how do we protect private property rights in the United States, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's really important. But also work with clients on congressional testimony. I've worked with hundreds of people that do congressional testimony. And congressional testimony, again, effective communication can help to shift that Overton window, whether it's on property rights, whether it's on progress, whether it's on removing regulations, mm-hmm. to help to enable the creativity of human ingenuity to flourish. I think the single best congressional testimony that everyone should watch wasn't one that I've worked on, but it's the best one, is 1969, Mr. Rogers goes to Congress. Right. And have you seen this, James?
No, I haven't seen this. Is he arguing for PBS funding or what?
Yeah. Congress was just about to kill funding to PBS. Mm. And then Mr. Rogers, just quiet, lovable Mr. Rogers, shows up at Congress. You can watch it on YouTube. And the congressman is gruff, has no idea who this guy is, and is a little bit kind of snarky. And then Mr. Rogers gives his testimony, and the guy just melts. Right, I think it's the senator, and he says, Mr. Rogers, I think you've got your funding. Right? It's just immediately afterwards, right? He immediately shifted the politicians on that panel and changed the perspective of how people saw public funding of PBS. I think at the time it was this sort of quaint thing. It was maybe like this luxury good. And Mr. Mm-hmm. Rogers helped to shift the framework to say that this sort of education can fundamentally help to develop kids' moral compass and sense of connection and sense of community. And it's really important that we support it. And so whatever your thoughts are on public funding of PBS, Mr. Rogers delivered a masterclass in how to effectively communicate to an audience that's not immediately prone to agree with you in a way that shifted the Overton window. So now it's not even something that we really debate, I don't think, too much anymore.
I like the example because if you're talking about someone who sells both eloquence and authenticity, it's Mr. Rogers.
He's amazing, right? He's so good. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So one of my favorite historians is Jacques Barzan, and he wrote a book in addition to one of this, like Advice for Modern Researchers. And one of the things that he mentioned is that no one in the history of mankind has ever been able to write a passable first draft. I got to think that applies to public speaking too. Everyone's got something to work on. But are there people who can nail it the first time?
There is a story at the beginning of the book Mortality, and I encourage everyone to pick up Mortality. It's a brilliant book, and Christopher Hitchens wrote it right before he died. And Chris Hitchens was one of the great writers and speakers of the late 20th, early 21st century. And the foreword to Mortality talks about – did you ever get to meet Hitchens?
No, James? I never did.
Okay. I got to meet him once. Like, he's just just an incredible character, right? But he also was a drinker. Like, he was probably like an alcoholic that contributed to his death. He did not live a healthy life, right? He lived hard. The introduction to Mortality, the guy writing it was his editor, I think, at Vanity Fair or something like that. And he says, or his boss, he said that it's, I won't get the exact details right, but the spirit of it was like me, Hitch, and a colleague, the three of us are at lunch. It's like noon on like a Tuesday or something. And there's like six shots of whiskey, three things of gin, two things of this and three things of this or whatever. And that was just Hitch. And then he says, and then after lunch, Hitch stumbles back to the office and in 40 minutes types up a perfect copy that gets no edits and goes to print. It's like mind blowing. That is not most people, right? I've never met anyone that actually does that. I mean, I briefly met Hitchens, but I've never actually worked with anyone that operates that way, whether it's writing or speaking. It is typically lots of iterations lead to success, 10,000 iterations, right? And so it's write that first draft and get it out as soon as you can, and then start making iterations and get feedback, not just from yourself, but from other people. I like to say that your first draft for a speech should be written orally rather than on paper, because when you take written language and try to convert it to oral language, the alchemy usually fails, right? Trying to make that conversion usually fails in terms of authenticity. So first draft, ideally, speak it into an app, right? Speak it into a tool like Otter and then have it transcribed and then look at it. Then you could start using your writing to make some edits.
That's some really good advice too, because if you're not used to presenting orally, of getting that order right, that's how you get your reps in. It doesn't have to be perfect. Say what you want to say until it starts feeling more naturally, and then write it down, edit, polish it, and figure out some things to work on. And I like that.
Yes. Almost no one is Chris Hitchens. And I will say, regardless of your level of excellence, showing up on rep three is almost assuredly going to be better than showing up on rep one. So even if you've been doing, say, donor meetings for 30 years, if you get a couple rounds of reps in, what are some questions I think that they're going to want to, what are some things I'm going to want to talk to them about? If you say, I'm going to show up, I'm going to do two reps, I'm going to get together with James over a coffee, and we're just pretend to be that donor, we're going to run some reps. Showing up on rep three, you will be substantively better. I encourage all of our clients to, at the very least, show up on rep three. If you're doing an interview or you're going and testifying or whatever it may be, show up at least on rep three. Now, if you show up on rep 100, you're going to knock it out of the park.
Mm-hmm. Bob, thank you so much for helping me develop or strengthen the tools that I use to shift the Overton window.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.